Hi, this is Alan McNish, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Steven, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Fall, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the show. This is podcast number 354, June 19th, 2009. Steven?
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by the Jim Russell Rotax Challenge and Marin Karting. Check them out, you know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and of course, we love the Northern California Jim Russell Rotax Challenge. On today's program, the FOTA announces they are setting up a breakaway championship series. And tonight, a special interview with Jackie Eakes. Nasser Hamid is now back from Le Mans with the largest goodie bag we've ever seen here at the palatial F1 Weekly studios. And of course, Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid in the flesh. Steve, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful. And yourself, Mr. Rogers?
Absolutely outstanding, and I just couldn't believe it. Few last-minute checkups on the web, and there it was, the Formula One Teams Association announcing late Thursday evening that they are indeed setting up a breakaway championship, meaning that they have told Max Mosley and his round table to take a hike.
What they can do with their budget cap.
Exactly. So there you have it. We're going to have a Formula One. And, of course, this includes Ferrari, McLaren, Renault, BMW, Toyota, Braun, Red Bull, and Scuderia Toro Rosso. Of course, Force India and Williams having been suspended for signing up for Formula One last month, I believe. So I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if this is factual. This is what I found. The photo statement is out there. And apparently, they just couldn't take it anymore.
Economic times be damned.
We're pretty much.
We're going to start our own series. And ultimately, you know, Max wants his budget cap. And if Max wants to run GP1 or Formula 1 as the extension of Formula 2, well, a budget cap makes sense. But the people in Formula 1 aren't there to race under a budget cap.
Not only that, Fernando Alonso comes out saying that he will follow the FOTA group and stick with the best, the brightest, and the beautiful.
And the biggest paycheck.
Well, pretty much. I mean, not only that, but I don't, you know, after this stage in his career, he just wants to race the best, most sophisticated machinery man can provide him.
Exactly. You know, if he wanted to go race in slower cars, he'd go to Formula 2.
Yeah, he says that he would rather race for an FOTA-organized breakaway series or another category altogether than compete in what he perceived to be a dilapidated Formula 1. So there you have it. A lot of people are going to be shocked in the morning, of course, in Europe when they read their copy of L'Équipe. And I'm sure this is going to be headline news in a lot of papers, not so much here. But I think this is big, and I can't wait.
I'd be
interested
to see if it had made the papers over here.
Well, I can't wait to hear Max and his statement. Of course, Bernie, I'm sure, is already rounding up the lawyers and getting everything prepared to sue everyone possible for breach of some kind of contractual agreement.
You know, I'm thinking because the Concord Agreement was not renewed, that Bernie really doesn't have a lot of control on them. And who's to say that Bernie wouldn't be running the show for the FOTA?
Yeah. And don't forget, Ferrari apparently are contracted to Formula One till 2012. But who's to say Ferrari could just throw two cars in Formula One with Marc Genet and somebody else driving while Felipe Massa and Kimi Raikkonen are driving in the Photo Championship.
In the Formula 1.1.
Whatever. I don't know. I can't even think of what kind of name they're going to have. But it's going to be fascinating.
The Grand Prix World Championship.
Well, could they use Grand Prix? Will Bernie freak out on that?
Grand Prix, as we've discovered, is really a generic term. And you really can't copyright that. They couldn't race in a Formula One Grand Prix Championship because then Formula One would be part of the name. But, you know, maybe it'll be the FOTA Championship.
And it's interesting because, of course, this is the Silverstone British Grand Prix this weekend. Are you pumped up for that or what?
Should be interesting. Should be really interesting now. Except the problem is that no one's going to be talking about the race. They're all going to be talking about the breakaway.
Well, what's going to happen is Jenson Button's going to go out there, win the race. Nobody's going to notice because they're going to be talking about the FOTA breakaway series.
Exactly. So it will be interesting to see if this really pans out or is this kind of the last-ditch effort to get Max to buckle.
And this changes everything. I mean, Damon Hill's out praising the British Grand Prix, saddened that it could be the last one at Silverstone, you know, or even possibly the last British Grand Prix. Of course, he won at Silverstone in 1994, and of course, he says that history is vital to Formula One and the loss of a venue that has hosted Grand Prix on and off since the World Championship began in 1950 and every year since 87 will be detrimental to the sport. Unfortunately, the sport is imploding right now.
Not only that, but unfortunately he didn't mention that after they pulled Indy off of the schedule. You know, Indy had been around as long in Formula One. You know, they'd only been there 5 years in the most modern era. But that was a race that was part of Formula One back in the day.
Back in the vintage days, Steven.
Exactly. Back when Damon Hill was racing.
You mean his father, Graham Hill.
Oh, Graham. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows? Maybe Silverstone comes back to the schedule. A lot of it hinges on whether or not Bernie still runs the back end of the show. And it's just they basically have dumped their regulating body and are going to pick up a new regulating body.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, Donington's saying that they've signed a 17-year deal, but, you know, people say on paper it's hard to believe that they'll be able to even have the track ready for next year. And on top of that, with Formula One collapsing, I'm sure Bernie right now is on the horn with Max, saying, Max, what have you done to my
golden goose. You've just turned my golden goose into foie gras.
And how could a regulating body just take a fantastic series and just regulate it into the ground?
It comes down to the fact that Max should have retired, you know, at least three terms ago, and someone else with a different... Max's vision for the sport is a little too narrow, and he's too big on his vision being it. There's no in-between.
Not only that, but they should have term limits. These guys should only, I would say, they should be president maybe for 5 or 6 years, and somebody has to take their place.
Or 10 to 12.
You know, you need fresh blood.
Yeah, you can't go that long. No, the problem is that, you know, so many of the people that are involved in the FIA these days are his cronies. So there's got to be some reason why he's pushing this, because it must be going to bring money to people that will bring money to him.
Right. And in the end, Max Mosley refused to budge. I think he said he would double the cap. But then in 2011, it would have to be back to £40 million. In the end, he was the one that just wouldn't compromise. And they just constantly hammered the FOTA. And he was trying to split the FOTA. He was hoping that there would be infighting in the group. And slowly, each one, like BMW And that he McLaren could
pull a couple of the manufacturers away and kind of erode the foundation.
Exactly, which that didn't happen. I mean, they are united, and I'm very impressed with Di Montezemolo doing an outstanding job in keeping this all together. I think it's exciting.
That will be interesting. You know, even if we run Formula One, you know, with a $40 million cap, you know, they've actually gotten enough teams to submit bids that they could actually still run the series. And if Bernie can force, you know, basically can force some of the teams, I guess, you know, if Ferrari can throw two extra cars onto the grid, I can't see why McLaren couldn't run this year's car next year with a skeleton crew. You know, you run a cheap crew over there.
Well, what's going to happen is Formula One could become the GP2 or the feeder series to this new breakaway series. There are so many scenarios. It's really incredible that this is actually happening. I still can't quite believe it.
Yeah, well, let's see if it really pans out in the next couple days. But it sounds to me like they're pretty much starting their role.
Exactly. Any predictions for Silverstone? Steve, come on. Go out.
Oh, let's see. Jensen Button. Wait. You know, I'd like to see when the Red Bulls do it. I haven't heard what the weather's going to be this weekend. If it's wet weather like it was a year ago, then I think the Red Bulls have a significantly better chance because Vettel is, a better wet driver.
Well, certainly Rubinho is out to spoil Mr. Bouton's party.
Yeah, and I don't think Ross will let him.
But, you know, that's a tough call. It is the British Grand Prix, and he's British. And, you know, Nigel Mansell is probably going to be over there rooting and hollering. It's going to be a tough call for Ross Brawn because certainly you can never call Rubinho number two because he's just too sensitive.
Well, you don't need to call him. He is, in fact, pretty much. You don't need to tell him he is because you can kind of see the writing on the wall when his teammate's got almost twice as many points.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping that Red Bull has made some upgrades, and they'll be able to compete a little bit better, even though I still believe that Braun has been sandbagging and they have extra power that they could bring out whenever they want.
A little extra speed when they need it. Will be interesting to see. Maybe, you know, the Williams can kind of make a bounce back. You know, Nico's been fast in practice all season, but has not been able to translate that into the track on Sunday.
So. I agree. And he always makes it to Q3. He's made it to Q3 every race this season. So he's doing a good job. And also, speaking of Nico, apparently I've been reading that he's been eyeing a seat at BMW. But with this new breakaway series, is all of this relevant anymore?
Well, everything is kind of up in the air. You would figure that the people with contracts with the breakaway teams now have contracts in the new breakaway series. It's those other seats and then the people who are maybe whose contracts are expiring this year that it starts to get a little bit more muddled.
Well,
and then who's coming up? Who would be, you know, the new young drivers?
The Grosjeans?
Yeah, to start next season, you know, and then you get into the whole thing, you know, all these race drivers have super licenses issued by the FIA. Do you have to recreate the whole FIA infrastructure to have a breakaway series?
Well, now they're going to be FOTA super licenses.
Yeah, so it's kind of confusing. There's a lot of bureaucracy that's going to have to be replicated unless basically they go to Max and go, hey, we're starting a new series. You want to regulate it? Because we're going to tell you how it's run this time.
Well, when Nasser comes in the studio, I know he's going to have a lot of goodies. He might have heard a few things around the water bottle at Le Mans in the break room. So that's going to be exciting. Real quickly before we go to break, I want to mention that Danica Patrick, a lot of talk there for her in USF1. USF1 is on the entry list for Formula One 2010. And, you know, Peter Windsor has been out talking about they're looking at drivers, you know, Jonathan Summerton, Danica Patrick, who knows what they're going to get. But she just put out a statement today or yesterday saying that she's admitted that NASCAR could be very attractive.
It's called money.
Yeah.
I don't see her. I see her being even less competitive in NASCAR than she is in Indy. And I also don't see her going into any international series. She's done her stint in England, and she gets homesick very easily.
Wow. Keep an open mind there, Steven. I like it. And really quickly, Ralf Schumacher has been in the press. He's back doing a couple of Q&A sessions, and
He wants to get back into Formula One?
No, 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 nothing like that. He's not. No. Well, maybe next year's Formula One. There's going to be some open seats.
Exactly.
But he's admitted that he's not having a very good season, even with the new car and everything.
We expected him to have a good season?
He says it's been difficult. I've been a bit unlucky at times, but I'm sure I'm really at home in the new car. Whatever that means. Keep up the good work, Ralphie.
Does that mean he's sleeping in it?
No, but unfortunately...
he possessed his house?
Rumor has it that the word half Schumacher is now being spread in the DTM paddock.
Oh, that's not good.
It's very sad. So anyway, there you have it. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Nasser Hamid. We just saw the limo pull up, so we're going to give him a chance to get his green tea in the F1 Weekly Palatial Cafeteria. So we'll be back after this brief message.
Are you between the ages of 8 and 80 and want to experience the thrill of wheel-to-wheel racing for yourself? Do you want a hobby that you, your family, or group of friends can share? The Jim Russell Northern California Rotex Challenge Series, sponsored in part by Marin Karting, is the fast-growing Northern California series of the Rotex Max Challenge USA and can lead to an FIA-approved world championship. Rotex answers your dream of racing. With a reliable engine that's sealed, keeps carts on the same level playing field, your operating costs low, your fun level high, and your skill determining your success. Be your own number one driver as part of the Jim Russell Northern California Rotex Challenge Series. Race on to NorCalRotex.com to learn more. And see MarinKarting.com for Rotex engines, parts, and accessories.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and Nasser Hamid. Nas, welcome to the studio. How was the trip to La France, Le Mans, Peugeot?
Come on.
It must have been exciting.
Well, the trip was on a scale of 1 to 10. Around 12 plus.
That's usually a good France trip.
Yeah, it was excellent. And I tell you, you know, it's good to be back in Cali. And hello to everyone. Nice to know. This was the best part of my, when I came back, that my day job and my fantasy job, which is right here at the palatial head office of F1 Weekly, are still there and not outsourced yet to Rangoon or Cameroon, which would have been real Sol Makosa.
Exactly. Well, Max was trying to get us to move, but we fought him.
He fought the law and won.
Exactly.
So what are you now?
Trying to get us to do a budget cap, too.
Yeah, so what's your name now? Clark Fota Rogers?
No, we're sticking with the Duke of Dijon.
Okay, that's fine. And, you know, of course, long trip, fighting some jet lag, but very glad that I was forced into this vacation. This vacation was not on the, at least on my personal agenda. And... I must say, you know, after being there for a few days, land of Fromage is fantastic and people very helpful. So very, very pleasant trip. And I now have a better understanding of your fondue fantasies. Well, I have a few of my own, and top of the list now is to get back there as soon as possible. When is your trip there, sir?
I'm leaving next month, July 8th. I landed Brussels because I don't like the hectic Charles de Gaulle airport.
Well, it was fairly convenient. I had no problem.
Well, good for you. You must have been at that other end. But I just go to Brussels because my brother lives in northern France.
More convenient for you?
It is more convenient.
Okay. You have a brother in southwest also, right?
I have a brother in the south of France and I have a sister in the middle of France, not too far from Le Mans.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Of course, I do drive to Paris to pick up some friends, and then we have a good time.
That's good. And, you know, my French trip started with a little Spanish sideshow, as I had explained to you before I left. I spent a day in Madrid, and my thanks to F1 Weekly listener, Mr. John Williamson, for giving me a tour of beautiful downtown Madrid. And we had dinner there, so now I can say I've had gazpacho in the land of muy macho.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was a nice place, and I enjoyed last year Barcelona also very much. So it was good to see the other big Spanish city, capital, of course. And first stop in France was at the Jean-Pierre Beltoise circuit in Trappes near Paris. And this is quite a big happening place. It's not. I thought it was going to be like just a fun go-karting thing. This is a pretty serious operation. it was very nice meeting him and talking to him about the old Matra days, his friendship and association with Francois Sauvet, and how he met him and his sister Jacqueline, who is now his wife. And you know what? He was so nice, and I was talking to him about Sauvet because I started following in 73. And I said to him, you know, if I come back and I have some more time and you have some more time, can we get together and have lunch with your wife also? And he said, yeah, sure, no problem. That was nice. And before he showed up, you know, he almost not made it because he lived somewhere near Paris. And he told me that when he was coming, there was some road construction going on and his car got into a ditch. So he had to call out to service. So in the meantime, I was talking to his son, Julien, one of the two sons. The other is Anthony. He was at Le Mans. And Julien was telling me that he used to race. And he said, I don't want to say this, but the two guys who were better than me were Franck Montagny and Jenson Button. So small world, huh? And, you know, we'll try to put these interviews week by week, and hopefully we'll get them out in the next few weeks. And any questions you may have, sir?
How was the weather, the people of France, everything was well?
Well, people of France were the main reason why the trip was so good, because, you know, you have to deal with people no matter where you go. So very friendly and very helpful, no problem there. And the weather was also very good. Just did a lot of walking. And you've seen how things are at the track, you know, from here to there. And you talk to somebody, oh, he's at the paddock. Paddock is like a mile down. And Le Mans is a big place. So there was a lot of walking. So it was good. And when I got to Le Mans, as I was explaining to you earlier, parking was no problem right in front of the main gate on Thursday and Friday. But race day was a very different story. Race day, I had to basically drive away from the track, park my car at a Novotel with their express written consent that I could park the car there, and took the tramway. Tramway brought me into tramway light rail for locals, brought me into the Le Mans track, which was pretty cool. So if somebody's going there next year and needs some travel tips, I'm not the expert, but I can share some experiences.
So stay at Novotel.
Okay, well, you stay at Novotel if you're making big bucks like Clark Rogers.
Exactly.
But if you're one of the masses, poor people of Paris, then what you do, you stay maybe half an hour. Because you know what these places do in major events is that, A, prices are up three times.
Just like everywhere else.
Exactly, and minimum 3-4 days. So what I thought is you stay somewhere else, take the train to the Novotel Hotel, and from there take the tramway. So, different strokes for different folks.
Understood.
And Andy Chittum, Madman Motors, and his wife, newlyweds, Jennifer, they were there also. We did not get to meet, but we were communicating by email. So, my congratulations to them on their marriage, and hope they had a... What better place to celebrate your honeymoon than a 24-hour motor race?
That is the best place.
Yeah. Where did you go for your honeymoon?
Me?
Garlic Festival.
Exactly.
Please, the lady. Yeah. I feel the pain.
Thank you.
Okay, what else we have? Okay, in terms of some of the interviews I did, then I spoke to four-time Le Mans winner, Mr. Henri Pescarolo, and he, you know, it's interesting when you talk to people, if there is somebody in racing that you have known who may have a very good reputation or a very bad reputation, and then you meet some people who have done business or worked for them or race with them, then it's interesting how different people have different experiences. And I'll share a couple of those here. In the case of Henri Pescarolo, you know, his career was elevated just like Jean-Pierre Bertrand's by Matra. So he was very thankful to them, especially Mr. Jean-Luc Lagardère, the head of Matra Motorsports. And then he was kind of also bitter about them, saying that he tried to destroy his career when they dropped him and brought in Chris Amon. And he says, you know, I had given Matra success in sports car racing, in Formula 3. Anytime I had a good car, I would win. But he did not feel very cool about getting dropped off in favor of Chris Amon. And Pescarolo, believe it or not, was teammate to Ayrton Senna for a sports car race at the Nürburgring. And he talks about that also in this interview, which we'll post in the next few weeks. So great conversation there. My thanks to him and also his wife. I was emailing her, and this was coordinated through her. And now we come to the feature interview today, Mr. Jackie Ickx. Thanks to his daughter, Larissa Ickx, this really, you know, would not have happened had I not run into her. And I had exchanged some emails with her also. Thanks to her, I was able to have a chat with the father, Mr. Jackie Ickx. And this guy, man, he won Le Mans many times, scored his first Formula One victory in France at Rouen, 1968, and also won the Can-Am Championship here in the U.S. And when I was doing some reading on him, I was very surprised to find out that he even won the Bathurst 1000 in Australia.
It's impressive.
Yeah, it's a very different race, very different type of car. So I asked him, how did you end up there? So he'll explain that gladly in the interview. Very well-read, very educated, very classy guy. And now lives in Monte Carlo.
He's also in Speed Merchants, is he not?
Jackie Ickx has to be.
He does an interview in there.
Yeah, because he was racing all kind of stuff. Incredible story. He was a Ferrari driver at the age of 23. And so I told him, first he says to me, why would somebody want to talk to me? I haven't raced in so many decades. I says, you have fans in America, all over the world. I'm one of them. And I says, you know, you need to come to the United States. So I was talking to him. Obviously, I'm not his agent. But, you know, there's Monterey Historics coming up here in August. If he was invited, he would have certainly brought that up. I'm thinking of contacting this company that does that, that, hey, they should contact him because he won with Porsche also, you know.
So I can't believe they haven't.
Yeah. I mean, Jackie Ickx is synonymous with Porsche victories at... with sports car racing. You know, one thing that was on my mind, but he was there to watch his daughter, Vanina Ickx, race there. And Larissa tried to get me an interview with Vanina also, but, you know, every time I went there, she was either being interviewed or was, you know, involved in something else. So you know, there'll be other times. But one thing I wanted to ask him, and just because he was there to watch his daughter, I did not. You know, when Stefan Beloff had his accident at Spa and lost his life, he was racing at Eau Rouge side by side with Jackie Ickx. In fact, the video that you see of in onboard camera of Beloff going and crashing, that's from Jackie Ickx's car. But I did not feel comfortable bringing that issue. Maybe I should have as a cold-hearted journalist, but, you know, I'm sure this was not the only time I will meet him. So did I do the right thing, sir?
You did. Keep up the good work with the F1Weekly.com ethics.
Thank you. I had no idea we had ethics and morals.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, moving on. Oh, and again, here, old contacts. Thanks to my old friend, Mr. Taz Harvey, who was from this area, Northern California. Another F1 freak and racer himself in the Speed Vision, now Speed TV Series Racing. I was introduced to Amy Saber, a California lady from Danville, not too far from here again. She was handling PR for Team Orica, which is run by Hugues Deschenaux, and I'm sure you know who that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he is the man who helped Alain Prost and Mr. Motivation. And even I told him we call Jean Alesi Mr. Motivation early in their careers. So a lot of good interviews coming up week by week. And Hugues Deschenaux also ran the Chrysler Viper program at Le Mans in days before they entered bankruptcy 24 hours. And thanks to Amy, I was also able to interview Olivier Panis, who was driving for Orica. And you will get to hear why he was crying for 4 months last year. There was a lady there, you know, I was not sure, but there were too many people. And she came up to me after the interview and asked me if everything went okay. I spoke good English. And I had a very strong feeling that was his wife. And I've come up with an idea now. Next time every now and then, the spouse is also there. Like in the case of Anthony Davidson, she was sitting right next to me, you know, when I was doing the interview. Next time we normally have one question about little personality or something, not very racing focused. I'm going to ask the spouse to ask the question, see if they will be more open or maybe more closed, depending on who the driver is. What say you?
It probably depends on the question.
It will be a politically correct question. Of course. Okay, and I just mentioned Anthony Davidson. Of course, he's doing podcast also, Five Live BBC. Right. And so I told him he'd do the same thing. And we also told him we also listen to his podcast. That's true, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're watching their feed also on TV. And he was there driving for Aston Martin with David Richards' Pro Drive team. And talking of Pro Drive and all, I was very surprised that his team was not selected for the F1. But that's not only another story, but a story in itself now with all this happening going on. Naren Karthikeyan, he was the first Indian to race in Formula One with Jordan team, and past weekend became the first Indian to race at Le Mans with Chavsky's team, Colin Collis. And this is very interesting for you, Mr. Rogers, coming up here. In the race, of course, he was driving the year-old Audi R10. And I asked him about his plans or agenda for 2010, because we're in June, they're pretty much trying to sort out what's happening next year. And he said his management is looking at various options, including NASCAR.
Your favorite.
Yeah, you know, first they had a movie called Indian in the Cupboard. Now they're going to have a movie, Indian in the Backyard, or the Brickyard, excuse me, moi. It should be fun. Okay, if this happens, hot dogs will have competition from hot naans and some chutney on the side.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward to it.
Can't wait.
Yeah. Okay, more interviews, sir. Stefan Ortelli of Monaco, he was there with Orica. He is ex-winner of Le Mans. Do you remember last year, I believe it was at Monza, when one of the cars went flying through the air at one of the corners and almost sliced Alan McNish's Audi?
Correct.
That was Mr. Stefan Ortelli. And he has raced here at Laguna Seca also a few times. Christian Klein, this was very nice. I was able to talk to him. And he was with Peugeot for Le Mans and also test driver for BMW Sauber. And Dr. Mark Farrington and Mr. Brazier will be pleased to know that I was able to hook up with Ms. Delphine of Peugeot PR. And we have a brief interview coming up with her also. And it was thanks to her help that I was able to get to Christian Klein. So it takes a lot of, you know, worldwide connections to make things happen. And, of course, the last one just happened by chance. I was waiting in line for food, your favorite hamburger, and the man from Dijon Prenois 1979, René Arnoux, was spotted and stopped in the food line at the Trekside restaurant. And I asked him if I could do an interview after eating. He was there with his daughter and some guy. And he says, no, we can do it right now. So this conversation took place while we were eating for our cheeseburgers. And actually, I had to put the food for both his and my food on hold, and because conversation was more important, especially about Dijon Prenois. And I asked him about Paul Ricoeur, 1982, when, you know, signals were given, signs were given to him to slow down so Prost can win. And I tell you what, I got the impression that he's still very proud of ignoring team orders at Paul Ricoeur in 1982 and winning the race over Alain Prost, saying, I won the race on my birthday and said bye-bye to Prost. And he did mention that, you know, his contract was, there was no one or two. And Alain Prost's version is that he had a verbal agreement with him. So, you know, these things happen. And interestingly, Arnoux's birthday, which he told me, is on the same day as Jan Magnussen's. And that's the day the race took place, July 4th. That's the 1982 French Grand Prix at Paul Ricoeur. Yeah. And you're asking me how good the trip went, and I says 1 to 12. Keep in mind, this did not include trips to Dijon, Clermont-Ferrand, Paul Ricoeur, Metro Museum, Rouen. So I need to go back there ASAP. It just might happen before the year is out.
You'll love the Montre Museum. Very exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. And Paul Ricoeur and Clermont-Ferrand. So, anyway, a little break now. And moi will take a few sips of my tea courtesy of Mr. Host. Co-host, excuse me, moi. Mr. Steve Favre. And we shall return.
We'll be back after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Clark Rogers, host of F1Weekly.com's podcast. Please visit our website, F1Weekly.com, your fresh new destination for all your Formula One needs. F1Weekly.com brings you a weekly podcast that covers the latest news, rumors, and insightful commentary related to the pinnacle of modern motorsports, Formula One. You can find us on iTunes and other popular podcast locations. F1Weekly.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com as we get back to our Motorsports Mondial, Le Mans anecdotes, whatever happens to Nasser in Le Mans has got to be fun. And Nass, welcome back. You're having some tea. You're relaxing. A little jet lag still. Let's continue.
Yeah, I do have a travel tip also, you know. A few days before the trip and a few days after the trip, stay away from your dentist. I'm suffering. But, you know, I will survive.
Okay,
well, and what happens in Le Mans does not stay there. It comes here and is shared with all our listeners, and we thank them for their support. Le Mans is not Vegas. Okay, greetings and racing regards. Lion roars at Le Mans and an amazing Dijon Prenois 1979 style finish in Barcelona MotoGP race. And I got an email from our listener Javier in Holland, who was originally from Spain, saying you got to watch it, and I taped it, and we'll talk about this in a minute. And we have trouble at the top on both sides of the pond, and the European side F1 is now out of control. Let's see what happens. We shall start with the Le Mans 24-hour race. Peugeot Sports' hungry heart turns into happy heart as third time is the charm for the local manufacturer. On a scale of 1 to 10, how happy were you, sir?
About a 12.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Copycat. Okay, Peugeot finally brought down Tom Christensen and Audi's kingdom by scoring an impressive 1-2 finish. An international lineup of drivers from Spain, Austria, and Australia took victory with Marc Genet, Alexander Wurz, and David Brabham at the wheel. Were you disappointed? I was very surprised that they put all three French drivers in one car. They should have hedged their bets so at least one of the winning cars would have a French driver. What say you?
I don't criticize top professional teams like this for little things like that. They did a great job. Less mistakes, some stupid mistakes here and there, but in the end, Peugeot just outclassed Audi and did an outstanding job. And it was an exciting race.
Yeah, it was great.
I'm very, very happy for the mark.
Me too, and it was a very well-deserved win. They were flying last year, and we need variety. Okay, and the more everybody wins, the more they stay in the game. Okay, pole-sitting Peugeot of local pilot Sébastien Bourdais, and you know Sébastien Bourdais was born in Le Mans.
Of course.
Frank Montani and Stéphane Sarrazin set the early pace. They went down two laps after a wheel-bearing failure but crawled back to finish second. Deuxième, as they would say. I read somewhere that they were not happy campers on the podium because apparently Peugeot gave them orders not to race each other in the last hour, which I think was a very good move.
Of course. And, you know, there's always going to be unhappy drivers, but guys, it's a team.
Yeah, and it's normally the guys who are not on the top of the podium are unhappy. Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah.
It's called the effect of le cage rattling. Why do you say cage rattling in Francais?
I'm not sure. Okay. I'll have to give that some thought, or I'll call my mom.
Yeah, please figure it out so we can use that. We can increase our vocabulary.
Yeah.
Okay, what would have been, could have been, should have been an all Peugeot sweep of the podium was spoiled when the Nicolas Minassian, Christian Klien, and Pedro Lamy car was involved in a pit lane carambolage with the privately entered Peugeot of Pescarolo Sport. I'm sure you watched this.
Yes.
It was unbelievable how this guy was going all of... I mean, as soon as his star blew out, right after the exit of the pit, I said, this guy is driving now for many, many minutes because it's such a huge drag. At racing speeds, you have to wait for these cars to show up. I mean, it's not like Wilkes-Barre, every 20 seconds a car is coming back. So it was interesting.
It was exciting.
Yeah. Pedro Lamy drove one full lap on the rim. As the left rear tire was gone soon after he came out of the pits, the car went down seven laps but was classified sixth at the end. Andrea Pescarolo made an interesting comment saying, everybody knows not to bring a car in while another one is being serviced. And time will tell how this incident will affect his relationship with Peugeot for next year's race. And, you know, they wanted another car, you know, strength of numbers, and it almost cost him very dearly. Third was the Audi R11 is the name number now, right? R15? Okay. Audi R15 of Christian, Tom Christensen, Alan McNish, and Ronaldo Capello. Fourth was the Aston Martin Lola of Tomas Enge, Stefan Muque, and Jan Cheruz, who was from Czech Republic. Fifth was the Orica car of Olivier Panis, Nicolas Lapierre, and Sohail Ayari, all French drivers. LMP2 winners were the Essex Racing Porsche RS Spider of Emmanuel Collard, Casper Elgard, and Christian Poulsen. GT1 class was won by the Corvette of Johnny O'Connell, Jan Magnussen, and Antonio Garcia. GT2 was won by the Ferrari F430 of Pierre Kaffer, Jamie Mello, and Mika Salo. And Jamie Mello and Mika Salo race here in the U.S. also on a fairly regular basis. You know, I did talk to, but not possible to do an interview, but Mika Salo, I had a brief conversation with him, and I also had a brief conversation with Mr. Alexander Wurz. And again, it was not in circumstances where I could do an interview, but there'll be other times, hopefully. I did run into twice in non-interview environment Mr. Nicolas Prost. And Alain Prost was there on, I believe, on Thursday or Friday. And the following day, I asked Nicolas, hey, is your daddy? And when I asked him about his dad, he had a big smile. He says, no, he's gone already. So I'm still trying to chase down Le Professeur. Okay, now we move from France to Spain for the MotoGP race in Barcelona at the Circuit de Catalunya. Did you watch this, sir?
I only caught the beginning.
Mr. Favre, check it out on the YouTube. Unbelievable.
Exciting.
Last.
I heard unbelievable. That it was just out of control.
Yeah. Local boy Jorge Lorenzo took pole position over Valentino Rossi, and they are both Yamaha teammates. The young Spaniard had started every race this season from the front row, which is very, very impressive. In the closing stages, a great fight developed between the two, and this was in the same league as the MotoGP race last year at Laguna Seca, and I was there, an unbelievable experience. And again, both of them were like Taste of Dijon Pinot, but this time nobody went off, and great battle went to the finish line. After several lead changes in the last two laps, local hero Lorenzo was headed for great victory on home soil, but the doctor had other ideas on the last corner of the last lap and made a great pass to score another great win. And as Rossi said in the interview, it was to the last breath. Very, very impressive. And no wonder this guy is hailed as one of the all-time greats, probably the all-time great. This was the first time since Estoril, Portugal, 2006, that a MotoGP race had been won by a last lap pass. Rossi, Lorenzo, and third place Casey Stoner of Australia are now all tied on 106 points at the top of the MotoGP Championship after 6 or 17 rounds. And as I said, if you have not seen this, please check it out, at least the last lap. I mean, this is so amazing that it's all over the web on different newspapers, also on the front page. Very, very impressive. You will not be disappointed. Now we go to the Netherlands for some Dutch treat for a rookie, actually for a couple of them. The all-important Masters of Formula 3 race was back at Zandvoort after spending some time at Zolder in Belgium. The weekend saw the rise of serious racing talents and future cage rattlers, and no question about this. French driver and championship favorite Jules Bianchi took pole position but was given a grid penalty for what the stewards deemed was blocking of some of drivers in qualifying. His camp is saying there was no video proof, but three or four drivers complained that he was weaving. What the truth is, we don't know, but he got docked 5 places. And his teammate from Finland, rookie Valtteri Bottas, grabbed the opportunity and dominated the race from his inherited pole position. Another Finn, Mika Maki, was second. And interestingly, last year, Jules Bianchi won his first F3 race at the Masters of F3. So Bottas has now done the same thing, so very impressive. Stefano Coletti was third and Jules Bianchi finished fourth. Jake Rosenzweig, who I believe is from the east coast of the U.S., was the only American in the field and was 29th. Also in action at Zandvoort was the Formula BMW Europe Series. Here again, we have rookies rising to the occasion. Local driver and rookie Robin Friens took pole position in only his third start in this series. A small mistake in the race handed victory to another very impressive rookie from Brazil, Felipe Nasser. And no, he's not related to me. F1 Weekly listener Kazim Manzoor was sixth after qualifying on the second row, which is his best qualifying position. And we look forward to seeing him on the podium soon. Race 2 saw another rookie scoring his first win. This time it was British driver Jack Harvey. Felipe Nasr was second. And now a little word, not from our sponsor, but from myself, on Felipe Nasr. He is not only a rookie, but is really rattling the cage off preseason favorite and second-year driver Michael Christensen, who is from Denmark and who is a very good driver. He has very impressive karting credentials and was Rookie of the Year in 2008. Formula BMW Europe. And this is the thing I like about motor racing. You know, you think you have it, and then boom, cage rattler shows up. And, you know, it's a long season to go. It's not over. But looking very good for Felipe Nasr, and, you know, also very good for Christensen at this stage. Felipe Nasr is leading the championship with 110 points. Christensen is on second with 80 points. And very surprisingly, this rookie has only done now four races in his life. Robin Freins from Holland is third, just 1 point behind Christensen on 79 points. So, with two rookies, oh, this is very important. And we, you know, we spent some quality time in our creative, you know, ideas. With two rookies in the top three in the championship, this is the perfect time for the web premiere of the official team of Cage Rattling. And here we go. Thank you, Mr. Tapia, for some saber rattling from Aram Khachaturian. From Mr. Khachaturian to the land of cranberries, Formula Atlantic. Double header at the New Jersey Motorsports Park. Formula Atlantic normally does only one race per weekend. Jonathan Summerton took victory in race one over Swiss Miss Simona Di Silvestro. In the second race, Simona returned the favor and won by less than a second over Summerton, her second win of the season, and I believe this is overall third win for her in Formula Atlantic. Ex-GP2 racer Borja Garcia of Spain was third. Simona now leads the championship by 8 points over Summerton. So it's an interesting situation developing between Summerton and Simona Di Silvestro. Frederick Verwisch, we interviewed this guy at Sebring, was third. The Belgian driver has been on the podium in three of his four races so far, which is very impressive. He was also awarded $1,000 hard charger bonus for improving the most positions from start to finish. Please pay attention for the next item. Clark Rogers' very favorite racing series.
Le NASCAR.
Mark Martin was great in Michigan driving to victory in the Kellogg Chevrolet. With GM's bankruptcy, their involvement in NASCAR is looking flaky.
It's impressive though. Mark Martin is what, like 87 years old?
Yeah, after a 30% discount. And I did not read the whole, I mean, I'm very tired and all that. That I think that he was lying third or fourth, and guys ahead of him ran out of petrol. Winning, you know, you take the wins as they come.
Exactly.
Sometimes you can make history with these things also.
But especially at that age.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and the boys are in town in our backyard at Sears Point.
That's true. This weekend is the big Le NASCAR race where they actually go left and right.
Yeah, and I cannot. I want to see Monty or Robbie Gordon kick some Le Boutet.
You're not going?
No, you know, if I was planning to go and interview Daryl Waltrip on a Thursday or Friday, but, you know, I just got back, and I'll die, you know.
Yeah, that's okay.
I'm very tired.
We'll put Daryl off for another couple months.
Another few boogity boogity weeks.
Yeah.
But I understand you're going. You have a VIP pass.
Yeah, I'm going to be part of the Skoal Chewing Tobacco VIP tent.
Yeah. Are you not a spotter for somebody, Kevin Harvick or somebody like that?
Something like that.
Good. Okay, Jeff Gordon was second, but Denny Hamlin third. Monty was sixth. And, of course, I mentioned the race is in our backyard at Sears Point, also known as Infineon Raceway. Now we come to a segment, Surfing with the Aliens, seen on the web. Female driver hopes for F1 test. Natasha Gachnow from Switzerland is hoping to test F1 machinery with new entrant Campos Racing of Spain. She drove for this team last year in Spanish Formula 3. This year, Natasha is racing in Formula 2, and her cousin is already racing in Formula 1, Mr. Sebastian Buemi. More Mayfield mayhem. Jeremy Mayfield is now being sued by parts suppliers for non-payment of bills. More info on this at autoweek.com. So this thing is getting more and more uglier. I think what he should do is just my personal opinion, work out some sort of a settlement with NASCAR. I'm not saying cop a plea, but just, you know, the more dirt you throw, the more you're going to be in the news, and it's not good for anybody.
There's always Chapter 11.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't really get yourself off the front page.
Yeah, exactly. Tony George, another brick in the wall. According to a story on autoracing1.com, TG's sisters cut off his money supply. Sisters are saying, how can you have any pudding if you don't have your motorsports? So if they really cut off money supply to him, because, you know, they've been funding from their family's, you know,
trust fund,
piggy bank or whatever, right. You know, I won't be surprised if this series falls up in a year or two.
You mean the IRL?
Yeah, IRL.
No, they just got back together.
Yeah.
But nobody watches these races.
Yeah, nobody watches, and, you know, I think they have less spectators at IRL races than in the Chinese Grand Prix.
Well, you never know. Maybe IRL and FOTA can get together and put on some kind of a program.
Yeah, like have a 15 race a season, 10 of them in the U.S. That might be a great idea.
Well, there's good tracks here.
Yeah, there's
Road Atlanta, Watkins Glen, Infineon Raceway, Laguna Seca,
Road Atlanta. Road Atlanta. There are many tracks. It's not a track. Yes. Shortage of track is not an issue here. Mid-Ohio is very nice.
Very nice.
Yeah, Portland is pretty decent.
Yeah, Button Willow, one of your favorites.
No, you have not been there. Yeah. Button Willow is a very nice track.
It is a very nice
pretty
track.
Large
a lot of,
track.
A lot of car clubs go there and do slalom races and what have you.
Yeah, and you can get the best of Bakersfield onions. It's not too far from there. Okay, finally, some bickering and Bernie. And this was written, you know, before this news came out that now there's another series. Bickering continues in Formula One, and one meeting is followed by another, which brings us to this week's famous last words. Bernie Ecclestone was quoted as saying, "There are so many meetings, I wish I had bought some stock in mineral water companies." And do want to ask you something. With this new announcement that they will split the series, what do you think this is headed now?
I don't know. This just came out last night.
It on last night?
Yes, last night. They all met in Estone at the Renault facility because everybody, of course, is preparing for the Silverstone Schlemazel, the Grand Prix, the Braun domination, which we all know will continue. But, it was just late last night, boom, make an announcement. They are starting a breakaway series. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the important thing is how the FIA and Max Molina is going to react. And, of course, Bernie is going to have his lawyers out.
Yeah, I'm a little late on catching up on all my news. I was just like, wow. I mean, I really thought that grown men will work out something at the last minute. But it will be interesting.
Well, Max Mosley really didn't give him much choice. He just refused to budge.
Pretty much his way or the highway, and they decided on the highway.
No, I read the photo statement. One of the things, and it could be lip service, that they were talking about what they want to do is, among other things, lower prices for the spectators. I mean, what Bernie and, you know what, it's like this, when if you want to succeed in anything, you have to have passion. Enzo Ferrari had a lot of passion. Ron Dennis had a lot of passion. What I find so interesting about both Max and Bernie, they have a very serious passion for motor racing. Both of them were racing drivers in their 50s and 60s.
Absolutely.
They've been involved in motor racing, but nothing else, all their lives. And for them to just get into this system where it's money, they don't care about the U.S. Grand Prix, they don't care about the Canadian Grand Prix, they don't care about the race in the Fangio's country. They're going to take a race to whatever they are taking, but people cannot afford, they're not coming. I mean, it's just, it's not good for the sport. It's very bad. I mean, you know, I read, again, there was a news item about the small number of fans who were at the Turkish Grand Prix, and for a country to spend $150 million and then be in a situation where nobody can afford to come or is coming, it's just not good for anyone, you know.
A lot of the drivers at the Turkish Grand Prix in Istanbul commented that they should have had free tickets for people on race day.
Yeah.
Because they avoided, a lot of the camera angles were engineered to avoid the empty stands.
Yeah.
But in fact, they were just, the drivers were stunned that there were a lot of empty stands for the race in Turkey. And it's these economic times. I mean, nobody can afford $300 for a grandstand ticket. The best prices in Formula One were actually the U.S. Grand Prix.
Oh, of course. Very reasonable.
It's very reasonable. But I've been to Spa. I mean, I went to Spa in 98, and it was like $350.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that the prices need to come down, and they forget. Without the spectators, there is no sport.
Yeah, and like they said, there is no transparency with these people. They did this 100-year release, rights, Formula One to Bernie Ecclestone. Bernie and, you know, these people have made a lot of money, and I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, you have to invest something in the sport itself, you know.
Yeah, you can't just take and take and take and take. Yeah. And it's like trying to milk a cow without feeding it.
Not only that, but they always expected it to be there. None of these people really gave it to some thought that these teams would go away. All good things do end.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's very true.
And we'll see what's going to happen. I mean, Formula One will survive, but it's not going to be the series.
No, I'll tell you, Ferrari holds a trump card. If Ferrari goes to sports car racing, some teams, be it Renault, be it Peugeot, be it Toyota, whoever, they will go and try to beat Ferrari, because when you beat Ferrari, you are machismo.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so if they start a rival series, I'm sad to see it has come to this, but if it is going to be like this, so be it. And people are going to be, are people going to go and see Fisichella and Sutil battle for world championship, or they're going to go and see Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton battle, you know?
Well, actually, if it turns out the way it stands right now, next year Nico Rosberg is probably world champion.
With Williams.
Williams, actually, this is probably the best thing that could happen to Williams.
Yeah, but to win against who? Campos? I mean,
yeah,
that's Campos. Not exciting. Some of these Force smaller India. Teams.
It would be all smaller teams.
I don't know. I feel sorry for Williams if they do break away, because Williams, you know, the Williams years when they were beating Ferrari and Benetton, that was exciting. So, no, I don't know what's going to happen, but there you have it. NAS, another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with an outrageous interview. The man himself, Mr. Jackie Eek. So, please, stay tuned for that. We'll be back.
Our shout-outs last week, let's get through them now. The podcasters at F1Weekly.com.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, for this podcast special interview, NAS, please introduce this legendary race car driver.
Well, you know, the name says it all. Name does not need an introduction, Jackie Eek. But I'll say a few things about his career. First of all, this conversation took place at Le Mans. My sincere thanks to him for his time and sharing his memories of winning races all over the world. He was in Formula One with Ferrari at the young age of 23, which speaks volumes for his talents. He won races in the top tier, starting with the 1968 French Grand Prix at Rouen, a legend at Le Mans with 6 victories. He was Can-Am champion here in the U.S., winner of Bathurst 1000 in Land Down Under, and in the dunes of Africa in the Dakar Rally. So this is gentleman has done and won anything and everything.
Like the Triple Crown twice over.
Yeah, exactly. He now resides in Monte Carlo, and special thanks to his daughter, Miss Larissa, who made this interview possible. So I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation with a true legend of motor racing, Mr. Jackie Eek of Belgium.
Okay, folks, I'm here at Le Mans with the legend of legends, Mr. Jackie Eek. Jackie, first of all, thank you very much. Great pleasure to meet you. How are you today?
Well, today with the privilege to meet someone from United States, originally from Pakistan. Well, it's a great pleasure because we are in an unbelievable location, the 24th of Le Mans, as you said.
Absolutely. This is a magical place for you with so many victories. What comes to your mind first when you arrive here, or any time a conversation comes up about Le Mans?
Well, first you have to know that I came here for the first time in 1966. as a competitor, so it's a long time ago. That's more than 40 years ago, obviously. And, of course, we all come back here with a lot of passion and emotion because we all love the race, because it's an unbelievable race.
Your daughter, Vanina, is one of the drivers this year. How involved have you been in guiding her career?
Well, I've not been involved at all. She went to high school, she went to university, she made her degree in biology, and when she was 23, she decided to go into racing, and she did it on her own. I never was her coach.
Her decision to go racing after attending university, was that a surprise to you?
A big surprise. I didn't expect it, and she never told me that she wanted to become a race driver.
Are you happy she is one now?
Well, you know, provide someone does what he likes to do. The father isn't there to like it or not. She has to be happy, and obviously what she likes is to be driving and driving high and fast cars. And that's what she does in Le Mans. She drives an LMP1, that is one of the fastest cars, and she's the only woman on board. And yes, I think she loves it, and I'm very proud of what she does.
At the age of 17, you were a factory rider for Zundapp. Please tell us a little bit about your career on two wheels and how did this deal come about? You were so young.
Well, there is not much to say except that at that age, frankly, I love motorcycle racing, and I thought I was going to become most probably a racing motorcycle race driver. I thought I was going to do Grand Prix in motorcycle, and amazingly, when I was 18, everything turned down by the fact that I had opportunities to drive cars, and as you know, you cannot do motorcycle and cars at the same time. So when you are 18 and you have the possibility to drive cars reasonably well and successfully, that's the way I choose.
Now, what is amazing about your career is that within 5 years, you were in Formula One with Ferrari, of all the teams. How old were you when you decided to become a professional driver, or this decision was never made because it came so natural?
Frankly, I never wanted to become a race driver originally. I would have loved to be a gardener or... You know, these people who keep the hunting place and nature and so on. And I didn't decide that, really. It just happened. And in this time, to climb up through the different class of motor racing, you had to be successful. It was like going to school, in a way. The first one was sure to go to the next class. And as you said, reasonably quickly, I was in Formula One, and probably one of the youngest in Formula One.
You credit Ken Tyrrell for changing your life. How was your experience in Formula Two with his team?
More I go, more I get older, more I realize the importance of Ken Tyrrell. Yes, definitely. He has been the key of my success in Formula One. Ken Tyrrell at the time has a real credit to pick up talents in motor racing. And when he decided to let me run in Formula 3, Formula 2, yes, it was really a big opportunity. And it's only after the time has run and everything is behind us, because he disappeared, unfortunately, a few years ago, you realize how important can be someone in your life. And definitely, if my life has been, as you are mentioning, successful, yes, he played a key role in it, without any doubt.
Great. On July 10th, 1967, Ken told you about his plans for a Formula One team for 1968, and the next day, you get a call from Franco Lini, Ferrari team manager. How did that make you feel?
Well, you seem to be extremely well informed. And but the reality, yes, he wanted to have a two-car team with me and Jackie Stewart. But unfortunately, it didn't work. It didn't work because the Matra he was going to use wanted a French driver. So there were no room for me in the team, and I think he regretted it, and me too. But at the same time, I had an offer from Ferrari to join Ferrari, and you know, when you are 22 or 23 years old, and Ferrari calls you and say, would you agree to drive my cars? It's something you don't refuse. And even after all these years, still my heart beats for Ferrari, because it was really a good time. Maybe not very successful, as it should have been, but yes, it's plenty of good memories.
You know, at that age, in your era, it was very, very rare somebody would get into a top team at that age. Did you have a manager, or who was basically doing the deals for you?
Frankly, I think, honestly, at the time, no one had a manager. The first one to have a... I'm not even saying a manager. The first one who had a lawyer was probably Jackie Stewart at the time. Drivers were going. The money was not the key, the key role of the sport. The important thing was to run, to drive, and to be happy. The money didn't play an important role. These things were fairly easy at the time. But, yes, I was young going into it, and I was very proud that the Commendatore gave me the first choice, in a way.
Now, in 1967 German Grand Prix, this was your first Formula One race in a Formula Two Matra, and this is so impressive. You qualified third behind only Jim Clark and Denny Holm. What was your feeling? You must have felt that, hey, I've arrived here.
No, I don't think you can say that, because you have to know, still today the Nürburgring and the Nordschleife still exist. They are still racing on it, and it's still the most complicated race course in the world. But it's a fact that I knew the race course very well. And frankly, I do believe that driving a Formula 2, a good Formula 2 at the time, with the knowledge I had about the race course, it's much easier in a way to drive a Formula 2 than a Formula 1, because you have to know that the Nürburgring at the time is 22 kilometers long. We were jumping on the track 17 times. That means the car were flying on bumps, and it was difficult.
How good was the Matra car you drove to Formula 2 Championship in 1967, and who were the main competitors for you?
In 67, I drove two different Matras, one of the new type and one of the old type. When I was able to drive the latest chassis, or was used normally by Jackie Stewart, frankly, he had the best car on the course. But the championship, I did it with the two cars. And we were successful, that's for sure, because we won a number of races. We were a European champion. And I think Dunlop played a key role in that, because Dunlop was really very efficient at the time.
Your first Grand Prix win came in 1968 in tragic circumstances at Rouen, when Joe Schlesser was killed. What do you remember most from that race and day?
Sadness.
Absolutely.
I won, but everybody was sad. I was sad. One of us disappeared in motor racing in dreadful conditions, and no one was having fun at all. And it could have been much nicer without having that dreadful accident, but these accidents was part of the job at the time. That means there were a large number of accidents every year, and it was quite usual to lose one or two drivers a year, talented drivers. So we felt terribly sorry.
In 1969, we're talking at this place, you started last after walking to your Ford GT40 before the start of the race here at Le Mans. Was this pre-planned or something you decided at the last minute?
No, it was planned. Maybe it was surprising, that's quite right, but no, it was planned already, because the basic difficulty of Le Mans is to cruise over 200 miles per hour at the start, without having the possibility to wear your seatbelts on. That means in case of accident, you would have been killed immediately. So I decided to wait until everybody goes and take my time, put the seatbelts on, and then start. After, the story was different because obviously I start last and we finish first.
Now, when you say it was decided, was John Wire aware of this, that you would be doing this?
I don't think so. No, because I didn't mention it to anyone. Though it was a total effect of surprise.
Yeah, talking of John Wire, very famous in sports car racing, how was he to deal with?
In the English way, that means pure racing tradition. He was the man of the Aston Martin. He was involved in racing for a long time, but you have to know that even if you call it professional at the time, all the teams were, compared to motor racing today, they were real amateurs. No mobile home, no big trucks, no nothing, and it was very charming.
Can one decide who has more passion for motor racing, the British or the Italians?
Oh, they have the same passion, but they express it in different ways.
Very true. Okay, after Jochen Rindt was killed at Monza in 1970, what was on your mind regarding the championship? Was it something you wanted to win under the circumstances?
Well, it looks strange, but I never wanted to win the championship that year, and I didn't, and I think it was well written that way, because obviously Jochen Rindt scored the highest number of points. Luckily, I was even on points behind him, but you have to remember that it, being killed in Monza, he had no chance, of course, to defend himself. And I think it's, the story is well written on that aspect. Jochen Rindt was the first champion, first world champion, who unfortunately died during the season. And I'm extremely pleased that it finished that that way, because I would not have him. I would not have been happy about being world champion with someone, a competitor who wasn't there anymore. No, it's well done that way. I'm happy.
You know, in this day and age, teammates don't talk to each other. And in the old days, it was, you know, you would talk to everybody. Who were some of your good friends when you were racing in Formula One?
You know, you have to remember the motor racing, it's still a selfish and individualist sport. But it's correct to say that at the time, as there were no sponsors, the finance was not the key role of the idea of racing. And as saying in a way, even being called professional, we were real amateurs. We were all staying in the same hotel. We had dinner or lunch together very often. And let's put it that way. Yes, it was human.
Of your six victories here at Le Mans, why is the 1977 win so special?
Because that was the most unbelievable win in motor racing. From a lost, definitely lost race, we won it. And I think we all drove exceptionally well that evening in dreadful conditions, rain, fog, for almost the whole night, because we were last at the start with mechanical trouble, because I swapped cars from my own to the other sister car. And then we just did an incredible race. Even the engineer, the mechanics could not believe it will turn that way.
You were once quoted as saying about Ferrari, confusion is permanent, the car is never at fault, nor the engineer, Mauro Forghieri. The driver is always guilty. What was the environment at other teams like Tyrrell and Brabham compared to Ferrari?
Did I say that?
That's why I said you were quoted at, so I'm not sure. It's in a magazine that I picked it up.
No, well, frankly, we had some very good years with Ferrari, some bad ones. Some years the car was really the best possible one, the next one not. And it's because I think at the time to build a racing car was very, we say in French, empiric. An engineer knew how to design a car. Either he was successful, then it's successful. You think, now I know the trick to make it right, I will improve it. And the next day it was worse than the first one. But it was a little more or less that for everyone. There was a little small minor fault on racing, and I think we lose us a large number of races because, unfortunately, we lost races on details more than... it was not a fact that the efficiency of the car wasn't right. But frankly, my terms with Ferrari during these 5 years with the old man... I was always very well treated, and it still remains one of my best memories in motor racing.
Niki Lauda called Mauro Forghieri, the engineer there, a genius but a madman. How was your experience in dealing with him? He was there for such a long time.
He's surely not a genius. He was unpredictable, that's for sure. But he did his job with a lot of passion.
In 1977, this really surprised me. You won the Bathurst 1000 way down in Australia with Alan Moffat. How did this deal come about, and your thoughts on Mount Panorama track? And I ask this question because we have a lot of listeners in Australia.
I don't remember how I met Alan Moffat. I think I met Alan Moffat or maybe in United States or in other races in Europe, but he was a hero. Alan Moffat was a hero in Australia. And also... the equivalent of Le Mans is, as you said, the Bathurst, the Hardy Ferrodo 1000 in Bathurst. And that race was covered by TV nonstop. And it was just unbelievable. He was a real star. And I had the chance to drive with him at that race in cars who were not easy to drive, but he drove with a lot of talent, really. He was very fast, much faster than I was, but I did what I could do with him to win that race. So that's one of the strange races I have won in a way with Alan Moffat, great driver.
1979, you won the Can-Am Championship with Carl Haas. How much did you enjoy racing in North America and your favorite track there?
Very much, because Carl Haas is one of the most charming person and team boss. Oh, it was nice. Him and Bernie really handled their team for many, many, many years with many, many different drivers, always successfully. And he's not only a team leader, he's a nice person, sweet, friendly, and it's quite surprising in that motor racing world.
Now I asked Patrick Tommy this question, so I'm going to ask you also. Did you ever bring him any Cuban cigars?
No. Oh, maybe. Not Cuban, but maybe Monte Cristo, because I think he loved Monte Cristo very much. Yes, he never smoked them, you know that. He never smoked his cigar. He was chewing his cigars. That's the reality.
He's still doing the same. Okay, among the various teammates you've had over the years, your thoughts on a great American legend, Mario Andretti, as a racer and friend?
We had a nice and short collaboration. We drove together in 72, I believe, the 312 PB. And I think we won almost all the races of the series, probably 5 out of 6. We were unbelievably successful. I think we were the perfect balance in a way. We were extremely fast, extremely safe, and with a great car. So we won a lot. And as you know, Mario is probably the only driver actually... on this planet, or has been able to drive all sorts of cars, not only from long distance or Formula One where he was world champion, but He drove NASCAR, stock car. He had that unbelievable facility to be quick and efficient in every category.
With victories at Le Mans, Nürburgring 1000 and the Dakar Rally in 1983, which one is toughest to win?
They are all tough to win. A win is difficult. The Dakar is probably the longest and the toughest race physically, but they are all difficult, frankly.
Oh, okay. If you could go back in time, and doesn't have to be a victory, if you could do one race in your life that gave you the most satisfaction, what, or maybe a two or three, what would come to your mind?
Only one, Le Mans 77.
That gives you the biggest satisfaction.
Yes.
Okay, some thoughts on what's happening in Formula One these days. How do you look at Formula One? Are you still following it, the passion you have?
Frankly, I don't follow it closely, so I don't have the right information about what goes on, but for sure it's a strange planet today.
Any thoughts on some of the young talents who are in racing, like Sebastian Vettel, Hamilton?
There are plenty. That's the nicest thing about it. It's sport. It's in the hands today of young kids, extremely talented and intelligent. If you look around in Formula One, the average year, it's between 20 and 25. Formula One is difficult, but these kids are driving it with an unbelievable amount of skill.
So a young driver, let's say 18, 19 years old, same level of talent, would it be easier to get into Formula One today or in your era?
I think you have to start. I think first you have to start at the age of 8 doing karting if you want to be in. But I think to become a race driver today, it's much more difficult than it was 40 years ago. It's tough today because you have plenty of talented people surrounding you.
If I may ask, what's a day like in the life of Jackie X these days?
Nice and peaceful, because, you know, there is something I can't complain about my life, is that I received so much more than I could expect. I never thought my life was going to be as successful and as nice as it is. Plus, the privilege that I'm still alive, and I have to realize that I went through all these years with a lot of mileage of motor racing without being hurt badly. And I think really my guardian angel worked very hard for me, that I'm convinced, and I'd like to thank him.
Thank you so much. Great honor, pleasure. Finally, how about a message to listeners of F1 Weekly? And we have listeners in Belgium also, kid you not.
Well, I think it's a dream to have people surrounded by people who are listening to you about news of the world and who have the passion about motor racing and sport and being interested in what other people are doing. And I think that's a privilege in life to have a passion for something.
Jackie Eakes, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. And now let's go right to the wrap-up. And, of course, Steve has got our forum updates.
We got some forum updates by Miguel. From Turkey to Le Mans to Barcelona, the forum has been covering and discussing all forms of motorsports. Auto Racer Ferrari stunned everyone by announcing that he watched 23 of the 24 hours of Le Mans race, a feat matching the event. And since Nasser was on the ground covering the event, we'll have plenty of Le Mans matter to discuss for months to come. A mole placed inside F1 Weekly Corporation posted previously unseen footage of the younger F1 Weekly CEO and host with the most Clark Rogers. No formal comments were made by the corporation, but rumors suggest a witch hunt is taking place behind the scenes. Commenting on the photos, F1's fabulously fantastic femme fatale suggested that Clark may be partially to blame for global warming, since, in her words, Clark is hot. And he's really red right now, too. The Countryside thread is approaching 4,000 posts, and Tricky used it to announce he's going away for a few days. Tyson's possible firing, the Hurt and Heel Championships, the Prediction Competition, Montezemolo's feud with the FIA, Max counterstrikes, and Braun domination have generated intense debate and have kept former members happily active and typing away at their keyboards. In total, they have now made 57,934 posts in over 3,213 threads. Make sure you do the same, as Miller LJ, our newest member, and join the debates in the forum. Check him out. You know you want to.
And I want to add to another new forum member, which his name is François Sivert. So there you go. I got the forum updates a little earlier this week. So keep up the good work on the forum. We like it when new people come in because we know a lot of listeners don't join the forum, but you'll find that the forum is nothing but a bunch of happy guys and gals talking about racing and actually everything else.
And a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. So there you have it. Real quickly, the San Francisco Formula One group, they're meeting again this weekend. This Sunday, June 21st, 12 p.m. pre-race. The flag drops at 12:05 at the Overtime Sports Bar and Grill, 398 7th at Harrison in beautiful downtown San Francisco. You can give them a call and see what's on the menu at 415-863-1688. Marine Karting is proud to organize and support the 2009 Jim Russell Northern California Rotax Series. Marine Karting offers CRG carts, engines and parts for all carts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California carters. For more information, go to marinkarting.com or you can give them a call, 415-898-0999. I want to mention our MySpace, Facebook, and of course the Twitter sites. Everybody tweets today. Just do a search for F1 Weekly listeners, or by our first names, and you'll find us, make us a friend. And if you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email us at info@f1weekly.com. I want to thank everybody who listens to the program. From myself to Steve and Nasser, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.